Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Risk factor in space exploration is looming large today as astronauts prepare to conduct an unprecedented in-flight repair on the space shuttle Discovery. This morning, President Bush thanked the Discovery crew for accepting that risk.
Wish you Godspeed in your mission. I know you've got very important work to do ahead of you. We look forward to seeing the successful completion of this mission. And obviously, as you prepare to come back, a lot of Americans will be praying for a safe return. So it's great talking to you. Thanks for being such great examples of courage for a lot of our fellow citizens.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. President. We want to tell you that we really enjoy what we're doing. We really believe in our mission, and we believe in space exploration and getting people off the planet and seeing what's out there. So the steps that we're taking right now are really worth it, and we want everybody to know that. And thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us.
Well, tomorrow, astronaut Steve Robinson, in a pre-scheduled spacewalk, will attempt to repair the shuttle's underbelly, where heat-resistant tiles protect the spacecraft as it re-enters Earth's atmosphere. Joining us from Orlando, Florida, with the latest, Pat Duggins, news director of public radio station WMFE. You've been very busy, Pat. First, what exactly is the problem on the shuttle?
Well, the problem is everyone knows about the mosaic of tiles on the belly of the space shuttle. That takes the brunt of the heat of reentry, about 3,000 degrees, as the shuttle scrapes its belly against the atmosphere coming down. Well, in between those tiles are areas of heat-resistant fabric called gap fillers, and as the name implies, they're basically stuffed in between the tiles. Now, NASA, with its in-depth photography, found that two sections of this fabric have popped loose. In fact, there's about an inch of it basically hanging out.
I wanted to ask you how much it was, because in the pictures it looks like a dinner napkin caught in a zipper. You know, how big is it?
It's about maybe about 1 inch thick and maybe about 6 inches long. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, except that you consider that when the spacecraft comes back to the atmosphere, that could increase heating around the shuttle's nose landing gear door by about 200 degrees. Now, the aluminum skin of the shuttle, if you peel all the tiles off, what you've got basically is an aluminum airplane that can only take heat of about 300 degrees before it starts to melt. So any kind of a difference in the temperature like that could very easily cause problems for the astronauts.
Right. And what will this repair mission entail? We understand that astronaut Steve Robinson is going to be dangling from a robotic arm. He'll try the repair. He says there will be no yanking of the material. So what is he going to try to do?
Well, step A would be to reach out with his gloved hands on the end of the robot arm and try to pull the material out. If that doesn't work, plan B would be to grab it with a pair of forceps that he's going to take with him. And if that doesn't work, plan C is to grab it with the forceps and then take a small hacksaw out of his pocket and try to nip that material back. It's very unusual. It's never been done before. And frankly, if you've ever interviewed astronauts before, you know that they're a highly motivated group of people. But when Houston called up and said, you're basically going to go to the underbelly of the shuttle, even the astronauts were saying, wait a second.
We understand they did have those misgivings. And yet we're told that the shuttle can probably land with no problem if nothing was done. So what can possibly go wrong in attempting the repair?
Well, basically, if you imagine yourself as the Michelin Man, that's what the spacewalkers look like in those suits. They're huge, they're very bulky, and even though everything is very light in outer space, it has an awful lot of mass. So the big concern Steve Robinson has is that he doesn't want to lean forward and actually headbutt the bottom of the shuttle by mistake. Those tiles are very fragile, and if he cracks one of them, he may actually do more damage than was there to begin with.
Right, so, Pat, given that, in about the minute we have, what's happening between now and the repair attempt to get ready for this?
Right now, they're basically going over all the tools that they have. They had a spacewalk yesterday, and NASA doesn't like to do two spacewalks in a row because they're very strenuous for the astronauts. I mean, even right down to the gloved their gloved hands, it really fatigues their hands to, you know, open and close them because of the rigidity of the spacesuit. So they're going over the tools, they're going over the procedures, and then tomorrow, early, by our time anyway, Steve Robinson and Soichi Noguchi will again put on their heavy spacesuits, float into the airlock, and then if you could imagine like being on the outside of a submarine as a U.S. Navy diver, where it's all black, you can't see anything, and there are very few handholds. That's basically what Steve Robinson's going to be facing.
And Pat Duggins, again, just a couple seconds, but I should have asked you, why do it if they feel they can land without it?
Well, because basically NASA doesn't know. They say that they simply don't know enough about what the aerodynamic heating on that piece of gap filler might be, and if they don't act and there's a tragedy, well, they're, you know, beyond the, you know, the the humanistic problems it would cause for the space program. It could also bring the program to a halt. So as far as they're concerned, it's a simple fix, so why not do it? We'll have to wait and see.
Pat Duggins, news director of WMFE Public Radio in Florida. Always thank you, Pat, for your time.
I appreciate it.
Police in central London today briefly closed some roads near King's Cross Station after getting reports of a fire on a double-decker bus, but no explosives were found, and it may have been engine trouble that put the city on edge once again. Also today, London transit officials reopened sections of two underground lines that had been closed since last month's series of attacks. Two other lines remain closed or suspended. Well, more than half of all daily commuters here in the U.S., more than half take the bus or train in New York City. So how safe is that system? A report in this week's U.S. News & World Report argues that while steps have been taken to improve transit security in New York, such as instituting unprecedented random bag searches, there's much more to do. Joining us on the line is Brian Kelly, executive editor of U.S. News & World Report. And Brian, reporter Angie Marek reminds us that the New York City transit system has been targeted before, but a plot was foiled in 1997?
That's right, at least in 1997. There's possibly even a more recent one. Last August, there were some people arrested for possibly trying to bomb Herald Square. So they've been very vigilant and clearly anticipating the possibility that something like this could well happen.
Right. In 1997, the New York police were said to have thwarted the Flatbush plot. That was a plan to put three suicide bombers on New York subway trains, a chilling fact that we're reminded of. What is the sense of the subways, first of all, now? We understand that there's a lot that's being done since the London attacks.
Well, they're playing some catch-up, clearly. The bag searches are a big piece of it. That's the most visible manifestation. You see people in New York grumbling about it, but putting up with it. It's unclear how helpful that can be. There's so many people who use that system. There's so many access points that even the experts throw up their hands and say, you know, on some levels it's not possible. You can't do for the transit system what you do for the airlines, for instance. That level of security is just never going to be accomplished.
Well, in fact, Simon Reeve, who's a terrorism expert, says that random bag searches are just cosmetic PR, that they don't deter, and that further searching everyone, as you mentioned, as we do at airports, will only make an opening for terrorists to bomb the lines of people waiting to be searched. In other words, it will make it less safe. So what is your sense as to whether or not these random searches even work?
Well, I think when you talk off the record to some of these officials, the sense is, first of all, they're trying to instill some confidence. They want to show people that they're doing something. So, you know, sometimes the terror is all about the appearance of terror as well as the reality of it. And I think taking some concrete steps, have proved helpful. There's also, beyond the bag searches, there are some technical fixes that they're working on here, some of which they've rejected. There's a lot of equipment out there. You know, London has millions of, or I think a million and a half cameras through the city. The New York City system has a couple of thousand. So it's not clear that we would ever be able to get to the same point in New York that they are in London.
Well, some would say why. I mean, New Yorkers pride themselves on being, the number one city. And isn't there a little sense of chagrin that London has 1.5 million cameras while New York has, let's see, it's, I think your article says 5,700 with a far bigger subway system. And they seem to work in London.
Well, as we've seen, yes, it's pretty remarkable the ability that they've had to pick up these people based on using the surveillance cameras. And it may be that the London lesson does show that New York has to take a different tack. But to date, they have rejected that sort of really widespread technical solution. The cost is obviously enormous. They're spending money on other things right now. This could force them to rethink it. I think that the success in London is a big issue.
Well, Brian Kelly, again, of U.S. News & World Report, there is criticism of New York that they're not spending enough money, that the counterterrorism funds that were available to them since 2002, of those funds, only $30 million of the $600 million have been spent.
Exactly. There's a lot of reasons for that. They're bureaucratic reasons. I think, again, this whole issue of the transit system is one that really took a back burner, and people were not focusing on this until London happened, and then I think they all kind of rolled their eyes and said, well, yeah, we know we're at least as vulnerable as London is in New York, and that may cause some of these funds to move a little faster.
And why did they reject? Why did New York City officials reject some of the high technology that you just spoke of? We understand there were fancy gadgets like heat sensors and radar. and, you know, plans to implement them were abandoned.
Yeah, they viewed it as not proven technology, and said the money would be a waste. You've got tunnels there that are 100 years old. They're narrow. It's the old construction. You've got all kinds of passageways and sub passageways and nooks and crannies, and it's more than 2,000 miles long. There's 2,000 miles of track, and then you couple that with all the other rail lines that come into New York City. The underground New York is really almost like a gigantic rail yard. So it is at least as difficult as the London system, I think.
Yeah, dark nooks and crannies, we understand, make video surveillance pretty difficult. But we understand that right after the London bombing, police instituted 24-hour patrols of one of the most vulnerable parts of the New York system. Many of us think about the bridges and the tunnels, the rail tunnels that go into Manhattan and go under the rivers. And apparently there's a routine surveillance of all 14 of those tunnels.
Right. The tunnels, I think, have been obvious for a longer time. There have been plots thwarted to blow up the Holland Tunnel in the past, and there's been much more emphasis placed on those. It's when you get into this warren of other subway tunnels throughout the city and all of the boroughs of New York that you really run up against some really serious problems.
You are in Washington right now, where transit officials are considering random bag searches. But we're reading that, for instance, the head of public safety in Philadelphia is saying they're not going to opt for that at all. They think it's useless, and they'd rather have more cops out on the beat in the neighborhoods where somebody might tell them of suspicious activity. That's how they're going to go about security. What do you think the sense is across the country of how to best make subways and trains safe?
Well, in Washington, there's certainly an increased presence on the trains. You see police with dogs and heavily armed officers, which again I think is a way of reassuring people. But you also realize, I think, that there's a difference when you talk about a New York or a Washington, which really are more prominent targets. I don't think the folks in Pittsburgh have quite the same potential concerns here. I don't think a lot of cities, as we've seen in this whole Homeland Security debate, not all cities are created equal when it comes to the terror threat.
Mm. And by the way, you talk about the increased police presence in the article in U.S. News. A woman who's shining shoes gestures towards a guy getting his shoes shined and said he's an undercover cop. So not only is there a police presence, but even when it's undercover, people seem to know it.
Well, people are very aware of it. You know, I think it's particularly if you talk about New Yorkers, these are pretty savvy people who have been, trained from long years and experience in New York to keep their eyes open and watch what's going on around them. So, I'm not sure that the best defense in New York might not just be the people who take the subway on their own. They're very conscious of anything that feels a little bit out of line there. I used to live in New York, and I know very well the way those subways are.
Brian Kelly, executive editor of U.S. News and World Report. Brian, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And just ahead, President Bush has a wide-ranging sit-down with reporters from Texas. The topics, Karl Rove, evolution, and Scott McClellan's mother will explain. Much more coming up here and now. Bush is standing firmly behind embattled White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove. During a roundtable discussion with Texas newspaper journalists, the president said he had complete confidence in Rove. This is the president's first public endorsement of his advisor since Rove became tied to the outing of a CIA operative. To review, Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper says Rove confirmed to him that Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife was a CIA operative after Wilson publicly criticized the Bush administration for its claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Wilson believes his wife's identity was revealed in retaliation. Well, for more on the Rove story and the wider-ranging roundtable discussion, we turn to David Jackson. He covers the White House for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome, David.
Well, thank you.
And I'm sure that the conversation about Karl Rove really resonated with the group around the table because he is very much tied to Texas.
Well, yes, and also he made a point of saying that he had complete confidence in Karl Rove. If you recall, last couple of times he was asked about him, he seemed to equivocate a little bit. He said he didn't want to comment on a pending investigation. He said that anyone who committed a crime would be dismissed from his administration, but he hadn't really come out and given Carl the so-called vote of confidence like he did yesterday, and it was something he really wanted to emphasize.
Well, the president has also said in the past that he doesn't want to prejudge the case. He said that to you as well.
Right.
But he did make statements in the past that he would fire anyone involved in revealing the name of Valerie Plame. Most recently, he said he would fire anyone who broke the law in revealing the name, sort of adjusting that.
Right.
Did anyone ask, would he fire Karl Rove?
It pretty much came up, and he just swatted the question away, saying, let's wait and see what the investigation says. And you made a good point. Originally, it was if anyone was caught leaking classified information, they would be fired. Well, it turns out that's not necessarily a crime, depending on the circumstances. So more recently, he said if anyone was caught committing a crime in the White House, he would dismiss them. So he raised the bar a little bit. But he declined to say under what conditions he might dismiss Rove or keep him. He just kind of just swatted away and said he had complete confidence in Karl Rove. And the president didn't say this, but a lot of his aides are going around saying privately that they're starting to be very confident that no one will be indicted out of this case.
They're telling you that off the record?
Pretty much, yeah. They expressed a lot of confidence that they don't think there's going to be any legal action resulting from this case.
Well, let's move on to some other topics from this roundtable. By the way, was it in Washington?
Yes, it was. It was in the Roosevelt Room of the White House.
And we reported earlier on the space shuttle discovery, plans for astronauts to make some repairs during a spacewalk tomorrow. What did the president have to say about the, you know, beleaguered space program?
He did express confidence in NASA. Someone asked him if he would support retiring the shuttle before its current expiration date of 2010. He said that decision should be made by the experts at NASA, and he expressed a lot of confidence in the program, including the hope that they may someday go to Mars.
Mm. Well, and another topic that's making headlines today that he spoke to you and other reporters about, intelligent design.
Right.
What exactly did President Bush say about this theory that something other than science had to be involved in the evolution of man?
Well, it's something that really goes back to his days as governor, and it's basically the same vision he's always had, is that first he said local school boards should make these decisions, but if it was up to him, he thinks both theories should be taught and that students should be taught as many theories as possible. Let me give you his exact words when asked about evolution versus intelligent design. So that decision should be made by local school districts, and I feel like both sides ought to be properly taught.
Mm. So in other words, he was saying schools should have the choice, but if he had his way,
right,
both should be taught.
Yes, so he said, quote, so people can understand what the debate is about. And then the question is, so the answer accepts the validity of intelligent design as an alternative to evolution. And the president responded, I think that part of education is to expose people to different schools of thought.
Again, intelligent design, a belief that life is so complicated that creation can't be explained by Darwinian evolution theory alone. Some scientists who only want to adhere to Darwin's view in schools believe that this is a way of opening the door to bringing religion and faith into science classes. But did President Bush say what his own personal view is? Did he say he believed in intelligent design?
No, we moved on from there. We only had two questions each, and he didn't really want to get into it. He was kind of joshing the reporter who asked him about it, saying, you're trying to take me back to my days as governor of Texas, as if to say I have the same position I've always had.
What did he say about his nominee for the Supreme Court, Judge Roberts?
The thing that the reporter zeroed in on was about abortion, of course, and he said he never asked Judge Roberts about his appealings about abortion or Roe versus Wade. He said he didn't want to put Judge Roberts in a position to prejudge the case, and he didn't want to put the judge in a position of having to recuse himself because he knows that Judge Roberts will be asked about this at his confirmation hearing.
And how did that resonate with the reporters? Were there follow-up questions? Because obviously many people feel they know how Judge Roberts
right.
feels about abortion.
Follow-up was, well, what do you feel about Roe versus Wade? And this is a kind of a game that's been going on between President Bush and Texas journalists for quite some time. You know, President Bush has never said whether or not he thinks Roe versus Wade should be overturned. He has never weighed in except to say that he's pro-life and people know where I stand on abortion. But in terms of whether the Supreme Court should overturn Roe versus Wade, George W. Bush has never said, either as governor, presidential candidate, or as president. Mm. And he again refused to do that yesterday.
Let me ask you this. He's returning to Crawford Ranch for his summer break.
Right.
His polls, as you point out in your article, are at an all-time low. But he's recently had a pretty good week in Washington as far as legislation. What was his mood?
He felt pretty good. He appreciated the CAFTA vote and the energy vote, so he felt like he was on a bit of a winning streak. And he always likes to get back to Texas. You know, it's been a while. He spent several weekends here in Washington working on the Supreme Court and some of these other legislative matters, so he's eager to get back to the ranch. So I would say he's in a good mood. He's a little bit feisty. You know, he's known some of us for several years, and we have a lot of histories together, so he's joshing us about a few things, but that's to be expected.
Can I just ask what one of the joshes might have been?
Well, I asked him about whether he would endorse anybody in our governor's primary coming up, and he said, that's your first question? That's the question you want to ask? I said, yes, it is.
But it's a pretty important one. Remind us, for those of us outside of Texas, remind us of this race for the Republican side.
Well, Bush's successor, Rick Perry is being challenged in the Republican primary by the state comptroller, Carol Keaton Rylander.
Who happens to also be the mother of?
Correct. Press Secretary Scott McClellan. I think that was another reason the president was kind of joshing me about it, because Scott McClellan was sitting right beside him. And
I mean, we know all politics is local everywhere, but how unusual is it for the mother of the president's press secretary to be running for the president's former job?
Oh, highly unusual. In fact, it's highly unusual to have a Republican primary in Texas. You got to remember, the Republican ascendancy in Texas is of relatively recent vintage, and we've never really had a high-profile primary like this. And so it's very unusual. It's probably the highest-profile Republican primary we've ever had in Texas. And the White House, President Bush, made it clear to me and to others that he's not going to take a position in the race. They're going to stay neutral.
David Jackson covers the White House for the Dallas Morning News. He's speaking to us from Washington after just having had a roundtable discussion with the president on a range of issues. David, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, could there be a link between the London bombers and Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia? Also, is the U.S. prepared for bioterror attack? That's all tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. The U.S. military says six Marines were killed in action in western Iraq today, bringing the total number of Americans killed since the war started to more than 1,800. Today's news out of Iraq shakes countless communities across the country. Bellingham, Massachusetts is one of them. With only 15,000 people, Bellingham has six Marines deployed overseas. Here Now's Fred Tice paid a visit to find out what a town that has given so much thinks about war and Iraq today.
Bellingham is a town that is learning to appreciate its war monuments again.
We just moved the Civil War Memorial.
Ernie Taft is chairman of the town's historical commission. Bellingham has a long history. It was founded in 1719. The Civil War Memorial was the town's first war memorial because the war so devastated the country that no one then had to be reminded what conflict the monument commemorated, or perhaps because it was erected at a time before America got involved in so many wars it had to name them. The inscription on the monument reads simply, "The Soldiers' Monument."
We moved from Bellingham Center, right in front of the old Baptist Church. Someday an 18-wheel trailer truck would have came around that corner and just took it right out.
Workers are pouring cement around the obelisk. It's hot. The sweat beads on the back of a worker's neck as he spreads the cement. The entire obelisk is showing signs of wear from the elements. There's a patch of moss near the top. The monument is a reminder of how devastating the Civil War was to this little town.
There's 10 veterans of the Civil War that gave their lives, and their names are on that monument. So it means a lot to us, you know, and we have to show it the proper respect.
You can still barely read the names of the town's 10 soldiers killed in the war in the cursive script whose edges have been well-worn by decades of acid rain. After World War I, the town put up another monument to those who served in that war. And then, next to the new home of the Civil War monument, on the town common, came the monument to all the other wars since.
How this came about was during World War II, they used to have memorial kind of like plaques around town with the servicemen's names on them and everything, but they were made from wood and plastic. And through the years, they deteriorated, and they were taken down about 1960. So they were just kind of like thrown in the dump heap and just forgotten about. So the first thing we wanted to do was establish a memorial for World War II. And as we got talking more and more, we said, why don't we do all the wars and all the veterans that served from Bellingham?
Black granite slabs commemorate all of Bellingham's fighting men and women.
So it was World War II. We did Korea. We did Vietnam.
There's Beirut. It's spelled B-E-R-U-I-T.
We also have Panama, and we also have Grenada.
There's the first Gulf War.
We just added on Afghanistan and Iraq.
When the Memorial Committee decided to add Afghanistan and Iraq last year, they asked people in town to submit the names of their loved ones serving over there. People responded in droves. This small town of 15,000 people put maybe 30 or 40 names on the monument, and it created a website to tell the stories of those serving. So this year, they decided to do it again, only...
Just kind of, you know, lost a little traction.
Jim Hastings has made it his mission to gather the names of townspeople who serve in the military.
We didn't get as many as we had hoped to, and we put it off last Veterans Day and this Memorial Day also. So we had an ad in the paper a few months ago, and we didn't get much of a response. We know there's a lot of people who have been over there, and the kids that have gone into the service.
But people are not turning in their loved ones' names this year. Hastings isn't sure exactly why, but he thinks the war may be wearing thin on the families of those serving in it.
Well, there was a big surge of patriotism, of course, back in 2003, and, you know, things start getting tough and people don't want to really deal with it, I think, you know, and put it out of their minds. And
Hastings says he doesn't think he got one phone call since last year's dedication to the monument. His own son is in the Marines and has been in Iraq twice. Hastings himself was a Marine in Vietnam.
Haven't been in the military, you know, it's tough. You know, it's something we can't turn away from now. We got to support it. We got to stay behind these people and, you know, in our country. And just, you know, it's a tough situation. You know, you see these kids and you just, it's a whole different ball game from anything else we've ever done. It was tough in Vietnam not knowing who people were, but this is going to be a nightmare. You know, at least you had an idea where they might be over there. But Iraq, it's insane. It's a whole different type of warfare. It's something we've never experienced.
Towards evening, Megan and Keith Imloff settled on the town common for an evening picnic with their daughter, Madison. Keith Imloff says, like many young couples, they were drawn to Bellingham because it's affordable. Three-bedroom single-family houses here start at $240,000, and the taxes aren't high, Imloff says. He believes so many people here seem to serve in the military simply because, like the Imloffs, they're starting out in life.
I think that we're doing a lot of good over there, and I fully support George Bush on his actions, and I think he will eventually pull this through.
Still, Imloff believes it's time to consider how U.S. troops will leave Iraq.
I think that they do need to look at an exit strategy.
At the VFW hall, Stanley Durgan, a Vietnam veteran and a Republican, is more adamant.
I think it's time to pull out. I just think that they should end it completely and get out.
Sitting in the back of the VFW hall, smoking and drinking a beer, Steve Hansen, the bartender at the club's functions, sees a big difference between the party's help for soldiers and Marines going away and those coming back. Those going away, he says, are nervous and stay close to their families, but they connect. When soldiers return, they're much more withdrawn. He recalls one party for a soldier who had just come back from Iraq.
And as he was here, he basically sat on the steps on the stage with his wife the entire time, didn't move, had very little or basically nothing to do with anybody here. He was basically in his own little world. Remember your grandmoms and mums, those great big black frying pans? That's what his eyes were like when you look into his eyes. And he did tell me when he came up to the bar, he just unloaded a little bit and told me that his welcome to Iraq, he had stepped off the chopper. There were two other guys. He was standing in the middle. A sniper had shot one in the head, and the other one was shot in the face. They were both dead right there.
p.m. The train from Boston has just pulled into the Forge Park 495 station, just over the town line in Franklin. People are sprinting from the train to their SUVs. Not John D., who won't give his last name, he says, because of what his job was in the military. D., who lives in Bellingham, served in the first Gulf War.
We should have finished the job, and at first, you know, everyone was afraid it was going to be another Vietnam.
He wishes U.S. troops had overthrown Saddam Hussein back in 1991.
Now, as you see, it is, you know, placing itself as being another Vietnam. I have a nephew there. I have a brother-in-law getting ready, being shipped over there. I feel for him. But my son, he's getting ready to join as far as the military. So, I have to support the country. I have to support as far as my comrades. And the only thing we can do is just pray for him and just hope that things will change.
Asked how he feels about his own son joining the military at a time when the likelihood of going to Iraq is high, John D. says,
I'll leave everything to God.
Here now is Fred Tyes visited the small Massachusetts town of Bellingham to sample feelings about the Iraq War. Well, still to come, classical music as a weapon against poverty, that's the motto in Venezuela, where millions of dollars are spent on kids' orchestras. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz spent a week in Caracas. He's now a believer. We'll hear why. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, suddenly, don't those low-carb Oreos and pastas look a little silly? The dust is still settling after Sunday's announcement that the company behind the low-carb Atkins diet craze has filed for bankruptcy. So, what happened? In early 2004, over 9% of U.S. adults said they were on the diet, but that figure has declined to 2.2% as of last month. Joining us now, Professor Alice Lichtenstein. She's of the Friedman School of Nutrition at Tufts University. And, Doctor, some of us have a sketchy notion of this Atkins diet. For instance, that it meant you could have all the steak and bacon that you wanted, but no donuts. So remind us, what exactly is it?
Well, I think it meant different things to different people, but for the most part, it meant try to restrict your carbohydrate as much as possible, and the balance of your diet should be coming from protein sources.
And carbohydrates, again, breads, pastas?
Breads, pastas, unfortunately, some fruits also.
But, well, yeah, fruits would be unfortunate, but isn't it a good thing to not eat as much bread or pasta? Why would it be bad to have no or low carbs?
Well, for one thing, you end up on a very low fiber diet, which is not particularly good. The other thing is you end up eating a lot of foods that have a relatively high calorie density, which means that there are a lot of calories for a relatively small serving. And thirdly, you aren't really getting good nutrient intake distribution because you're cutting out a lot of foods, fruits and vegetables, that tend to be very nutrient-dense, have a lot of nutrients per serving.
So people were eating a lot more fat than they thought, high calories. I mean, you know, I understand that some were eating pork rinds, so that would make sense. But people were losing weight. So how come they were losing weight?
I think the reason they were losing weight is they were cutting out large categories or a number of categories of foods that they normally were eating, and initially they weren't replacing them. And this is really analogous to what we saw in the 90s with the low-fat diet, which initially it was working for everyone because, again, people cut out large categories of foods that they were getting calories from. But what happened in both cases is we figured out a way to eat around it. With the very low-fat diets, suddenly there were fat-free brownies and cookies and things like that, and now with the low-carbohydrate or Atkins diet, suddenly you got a proliferation of low-carbohydrate foods but still had lots of calories, again, right, like cookies and crackers.
I remember when the low-fat cookies came out, I won't name them, and I thought, oh, this is great. And I realized I would eat three boxes just to get a sense of taste or something because there was nothing to them. They were sort of like cardboard or something. So I would eat 10 times more than I would if I'd had just one good cookie.
Yeah, and I think also people just had this idea, well, if they're fat-free, they must be low-calorie. In reality, that wasn't always the case.
Right. Well, and so why do you think that, given that people did lose a lot of weight on Atkins, at least initially, why do you think there's been a decline in the popularity of the diet?
I think because although people lost weight initially, the weight loss was not sustained because they started making modifications which caused them to eat as many calories as they had been eating or more. And then, again, there was this proliferation of low-carb foods so that you could eat almost anything and still be on a low-carb diet.
But also, do you think that, I mean, experience with diets has seemed to be that people lose a lot of weight and they do well with the diet, but then they just don't want to eat that way anymore?
Well, it may be that they don't want to eat that way anymore. It may be that they're not as motivated to restrict calorie intake. But the bottom line is the only way you can lose weight is if you eat fewer calories than you're expending.
Well, Dr. Lichtenstein, again with Tufts University, as a researcher, could you have predicted this?
Absolutely, because I think we see these cyclings going on all the time with diets, and we still haven't found that magic bullet. There really is no way to have your cake and eat it too, whether it's low carb, low fat, low anything. It just doesn't work.
It's still cake.
It's still cake. It's still calories. And I think there's no way of getting around the first law of thermodynamics. You cannot create or destroy energy. And what we're going to eventually have to do is just settle down and say, okay, we have food. It's plentiful and it's cheap. And some of the most caloric food is the cheapest. And we just have to figure out how we as an individual can limit our intake of calories and try to get a little more exercise. And until I think we really internalize that and believe it, we're going to be susceptible to all these crazy fads and crazy extremes, and they just, from historically, they just don't seem to work.
Alice Lichtenstein of the Friedman School of Nutrition at Tufts University and the director of the Cardiovascular Nutrition Lab at the Jean Mayer USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging, which is also at Tufts. Doctor, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Put down that Oreo. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. Move over Germany. Many classical music conductors, including the Berlin Philharmonic's own Sir Simon Rattle, say that the future of classical music is in Venezuela. That's Sir Simon Rattle there conducting the National Youth Symphony Orchestra of Venezuela in a performance of Mahler's Symphony No. 2. In a country of 25 million people, the Venezuelan government spends almost $29 million a year on its youth classical music program. Since the program's founding 30 years ago, almost 400,000 children have picked up an instrument. And recently, a new musical exchange was formed between the Venezuelan Youth Program and the New England Conservatory's Youth Philharmonic Orchestra under the direction of Benjamin Zander. The two youth programs performed together in Caracas, and joining them on that trip was classical music reviewer Lloyd Schwartz, who joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Lloyd.
Hi, Robin.
You know, I just want to touch on something because listeners might be thinking, Venezuela, you know, this is the country that's in and out of the news because of economic unrest, it's an economy based almost solely on oil, a leader, Chavez, who has stepped down and then back up again, political unrest. How do they feel about $29 million being spent on music for kids?
Well, it's really amazing that this program has been so successful. It has really weathered all kinds of political winds. Mm-hmm. It is both a very successful artistic enterprise, and it's also a social program that is taking the poorest students in one of the poorest countries in the world and is really is getting them off the streets, giving them a profession, getting them away from drugs and crime and child pornography. These are the things that this country is really facing. And these students, beginning at 3 or 4 years old, they take lessons and they rehearse every single day of the week, including Sundays.
In fact, let's give a listen, because you did travel to Caracas with the New England Conservatory's Youth Philharmonic Orchestra. And let's listen to a little bit of the joint rehearsal. How many students are we hearing here about?
We're hearing about 300 students.
Those are kids?
They are kids. Some of the stars of this program have gone on. One of the people has gone on to become an internationally admired young guest conductor. The Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, probably the most prestigious orchestra in the world, has just hired a 19-year-old Venezuelan bass player. He is now the youngest person in the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra.
Can you describe what this is like to be around this program? What was it like in that room during the rehearsal?
Well, let me tell you this, our first encounter with one of these Venezuelan youth orchestras, and it was the younger orchestra from 9 or 10 years old to about 15. And they gave a performance for the Americans in what seemed to be a kind of large gymnasium with bleacher seats. And they played Beethoven's Fifth Symphony impeccably, great musicality and amazing precision. They played the Star-Spangled Banner in a way that was more moving than any performance of the Star-Spangled Banner I can remember hearing in this country in a long time. They really seemed to know what the words meant. And then they did as an encore, they did the last part of the William Tell Overture, the famous Lone Ranger music. And the conductor, at one point, after they got started, the conductor put his baton down. The kids continued to play, and then at the very end, they stood up so that they couldn't even read the music in front of them and played the Lone Ranger theme with such exhilaration and energy and enthusiasm, and precision.
Right. And they were good, right?
And they were fantastic. Right. I mean, people were crying.
Well, and let's just, you know, and then you that goes out exponentially because there are roughly 60 children's orchestras, we understand,
right.
112 youth orchestras, 28 professional orchestras that come out of this program. You also mentioned that there's a program for disabled children as well.
For handicapped children, there's 6 programs at the moment throughout Venezuela. Next year, they're going to be 21. So talk about saving lives. This is actually contributing to the health of these children. We saw a performance of what they call the Chorus of White Gloves, in which the deaf children are, through rhythmic clapping and hand gestures, are accompanying the handicapped children who could sing. It was just heartrending how, and the look of joy on their faces was just ecstatic.
Well, now Benjamin Zander, again from New England Conservatory's Youth Philharmonic Orchestra, you traveled down with them, has said it ought to be compulsory for every American politician to come down to Venezuela to see what music can do for a society. Is there really going to be a takeaway from this, or is, do you think people are going to say, well, that's awfully nice that the Venezuelans have these little orchestra things going?
Well, there's the New England Conservatory and then the Venezuelan Youth Program have now a kind of agreement, a friendship agreement, in which there is going to be this interchange. Venezuelan musicians and students are going to come up to Boston to study at the New England Conservatory. NEC is going to be sending faculty and students down there. Certainly, for Americans to see these young kids perform the way they do is very inspiring. We can be very blasé about music making and the arts. And for them, it means they're going to learn technique and interpretation on a level beyond what they have already accomplished. But it's a real question about whether this is a program that can work in this country.
Because?
First of all, there has to be a will from our governments, our state and local and national governments, to fund this kind of program.
Because while they're cutting music programs.
Instead of cutting it, which is what's happening. And there's also, there seems to be a kind of ingrained, inherent respect and love of music in Venezuela. And that, I'm sad to say, doesn't really exist in this country. So, you know, there are smaller programs for poor kids and inner city kids to develop an interest in classical music, to try to diversify the American symphony orchestras. But these are very small programs compared to what's happening in Venezuela.
You know, you almost sadly think, gee, if someone had just picked up Leonard Bernstein's baton 30-odd years ago and kept his love of classical music going, maybe we'd have the same infrastructure that they now have in Venezuela.
Right, and that's really what we lack.
Yeah. Lloyd Schwartz, classical music reviewer for the Boston Phoenix and for NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. So, Lloyd, thanks so much for paying a visit to us.
Pleasure, Robin. Really great.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team today includes Kevin Sullivan, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Stefano Katsonis, and John Berger. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer, Ken George. Deborah Becker is our newscast producer. Our interns, Kate Goldring, Joanna Broder, and Noah Susskind. The senior producer of Here Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.